All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fuck Nicks? What the fuck Godelics? How's it going? I'm tired. Can you hear the tired? I'm tired. I've been out doing it. I've been out doing the road on my own, living the life. A lot of reflecting. But it was a great week away. It was almost a week. What day is today? Monday? So I left last Tuesday. It was the real deal, man. Driving to one-nighters, just like the old days. But great shows. Before I tell you about that, let's set it up. Keith Richards is on the show today. Now, I talked to him last week on Zoom for like 15, 20 minutes. I loved it. It was great. But I really thought going into that talk that I would be less of a fanboy than I was in 2015, which I just was, I was beside myself. Really, honestly, beside myself, like almost out of body experience. It turns out none of that has changed. Right when I got him on Zoom and I saw him, I just lit up, and it was the way that I kept my shit together a little bit was like, I think I busted his balls just a little bit. Just a little. Just get a couple laughs at old Kiefer's. But we decided that why not just run the one from 2015 too? So what we're going to do is we're going to do the new one, and then we're going to run the old one, because many of you haven't heard that. And even if you have heard it, you probably want to listen to it again. That's what I'm just saying. Sorry if my speech is weird. I'm tired, and I think I might have a tumor in my head. So that's happening. Keith is happening. Big Keith Day today. But what a week, man. I did all the road things. I did the shows. I did the shame. I did it. I did the road things. Drove for miles, hours. I flew into New York, rented a car on Tuesday night, drove to New Haven, checked into the hotel at like 11 at night. Got up in the morning, coffeeed up, went down the street to the Yale Gallery of Art, spent some time with some Rothkos and some other paintings. Then I met up with a friend of mine, Dean Falcone, who was a pizza guy and a music guy. So we went and ate at Pepe's Pizza with him. He had a crew of people there. Some guy owned a bagel place, a cousin who wrote a book about pizza. We'd gone to Sally's the last time, Pepe's. We sat there. We ate like 90 pizzas, a clam pizza, a white pizza, a sausage pizza, a margarita pizza. Another kind of pizza, then the other thing, all pizza. Just, it was, I don't think I'll ever be able to eat pizza again. So that night, with a belly full of pizza and Italian pastry, I did a show in New Haven at College Street, and it was great. Great show. It was the first one that since New York, where I'm not doing openers. And I did it in New Haven. It was great. I must have done, I did like an hour and 35. Everyone was happy. Great show. Great venue. Good people to work with, nice audience. Saw Brian Jones, the Potter, up there. Then I crash out in New Haven, get up the next day, and I got to drive to Troy, New York. Now, Troy, New York, I've been to all these places, actually, except for Laconia, New Hampshire. But I played the music hall in Troy once before. Every time I go to Troy, it's such a like a beautiful old city. Same with Albany. There's part of me that's like, I want to move here. These are cool old buildings. But then what happens then? I just become like the guy who lives in Troy. Isn't that Marc Maron? Why does he live here now? I don't know. He did a gig here and then he never left. It's kind of weird. We were happy to have him at first, but now he just kind of moves around from coffee shop to coffee shop, talking to himself. We checked. He's not talking. He doesn't have ear pods in. But I actually did see an old comic there, Ross Bennett, who actually does live up in Troy, with another comic who I think, I don't know if they're married or not, but he came to the show. Nonetheless, the music hall is a magic place. It was built in the mid-1800s. There's a rack for a top hat under each chair. There's a shawl, the towel rack, like a shawl rack on the back of each chair. It's wild. It's definitely timeless. Yeah, someone should do a steampunk show there of some kind. But I've been there before, and it was magic then. There's perfect acoustics in the place. And I think I did like an hour and 40, maybe, hour 45. I don't know, but it was a great show. A lot of new things happened. Every show was different. Every show was just me. And then I ate at Nighthawks because the guy who owns the place had told me to come. It was good. And then the next day, I got up early and I drove from Troy to Laconia, New Hampshire, but I stopped at Mass MoCA first, which is that massive museum of contemporary art out there in North Adams. Amazing. The Mass MoCA is this huge space. It's many different industrial buildings that have been made into this museum. So a lot of the art there are installations, things that only happen there and only happen for a period of time. And there's many of them. I can't name all of them, but they're all kind of mind-blowing. What a spectacular way to spend like 2 or 3 hours. Just blew my mind. I did realize, though, that art doesn't give a fuck about you. You've got to go out and get it. You've got to go get the art. You've got to go get it. And I didn't even know why I didn't realize this when I dated a painter for years. It's an insulated world, and they're playing to the back of the room a lot of times. They're only concerned about themselves and about, you know, how it's going to be received by critics and by people in the art world. So you got to realize that you have to, that there's a certain language to it all. But you just got to let it go in there and let it, as I say, punch you in the brain. And if it's good, it'll stay punched. And mine got punched the fuck out at Mass MoCA. So then I continue on. I leave Mass MoCA and I'm going to Laconia. Dunkin' Donuts all the way, every day. Dunkin' Donuts coffee, jacked out of my mind. And I started to spiral on the way to Laconia because at the beginning of my career, I did one-nighters. That's how I learned how to do comedy. I drive all over the New England area, whether it was New Hampshire, Vermont, Maine, upstate New York, Mass, Western Mass, Rhode Island. There was just, it never, Connecticut. There were just gigs, one-nighters that you would go do. And they were always, because of the time in my life and what I was trying to do, they were always pretty horrendous in a way. Always kind of terrible. I was just this neurotic, angry Jewish guy running around to these pubs and bowling alleys and motel and hotel ballrooms and just regular bars and dance clubs that had comedy nights, learning how to do comedy. So it was weird as I was driving around the interstates and rural highways in New England to these gigs at theaters, they became sort of the neural pathways leading back to the trauma that I experienced starting out in this business. And as I got closer to Laconia and the more barns I drove past, I started to sort of flash back and spiral into that place where I'm like, this is going to suck. How the fuck is this going to be good? How many barns am I going to drive by? I mean, I was enjoying the barns in moments, but I was also like, where the fuck am I going? I even texted my agent, like, you know, what the fuck kind of gig is this? Where's Laconia? Everything that I did when in the late 80s, when I started doing gigs, I was doing. I had come full circle, but this was not connected to anything. It wasn't real. Fear and anxiety from the old mark, from the old days. And I had to reel it in, man. It was wild because it was full circle. I was driving to one-nighters. I was staying at hotels, which usually I didn't do back in the day. But I got to Laconia, and it's this beautiful little redone theater, the Colonial. They just opened. They've had a few comedy shows there. I think Jimmy Norton was there, and I think Whitney's going there. And it was great. Again, there's three restaurants in the town and, you know, a couple of coffee shops. There's a record store with a bar. But the audience was great. Everyone's excited. A lot of people haven't been out since COVID. I think I did like an hour 40, something like that there, hour 45. And I enjoyed it. But I was nervous. I knew there was going to be a snowstorm in Vermont, and I started to panic. I wouldn't get out of Vermont on Sunday. I knew that it was supposed to snow all day Saturday. So I got up at 6 in the morning after Laconia, and I drove to get ahead of the storm, and I did. It was raining, but by the time I got to the interstate, it just started snowing, and then it started coming down harder, and then it was like really kind of blizzarding, and then the road got slick, and I haven't seen snow in years. I used to live in snow all the time, years and years of snow, and it was annoying, but I always liked it, but I hadn't seen it in years. It was very exciting to drive in the snow. I had rented an SUV so I could pull it off. By the time I got to Burlington, it was like, there was like a lot of fucking snow on the ground. They let me check into the hotel early. I saw some friends. And I ate with a pal at Hen of the Woods. Amazing restaurant. Sludging through the snow in boots that weren't correct for the snow. Trying not to slip and break a hip. But the Flynn Center, I guess I got about 600 people in there or so. And I did like almost 2 hours. Hour and 50 minutes. Riffing. Doing the straight comedy stuff, doing performance stuff. I don't know. Every night that I did the solo thing without an opener, it felt like I was doing a play. It was amazing. I loved it. All the audiences were great. On the last night there in Burlington, some kid says, "You remind me of my father, but I don't like him." I like you, though. That's what he said. all the people were great. I did pay a little tribute. I think it might have been in Laconia because it was on my mind, the spiraling out from the old days, that I did a little memorial, a little eulogy for Teddy Bergeron, who was a Boston comic. That was around when I was working there, when I started out. A real character. He was really kind of a mythic guy. He was one of the first out of Boston to do Letterman and Carson. And he had a big future ahead of him, but he also had terrible alcoholism within him. And he was constantly at battle with that and with himself and with success. But he always had swagger. No matter how pathetic it got, Teddy always had swagger. And he had great jokes. Great jokes. Jokes that if I listen to now are still hilarious. Dark jokes about himself, about his father, beautifully crafted jokes. He didn't have, I don't know how much he wrote really, and I don't know how much he worked because I wasn't around, but we did a live WTF at the Wilbur, and I had to find somebody that would find him. Somebody had to tell me that I had to call another Teddy, who was his cousin Teddy, to get the other Teddy, and I didn't know if Teddy Bergeron was going to show up at the Wilbur. This was like in 2013, a live one. We used to do live ones. There's a bunch of other Boston comics on the panel. And, you know, Teddy shows up with his ever red hair and he's wearing sweats and he's antsy. And he's like, I said, well, you good? He goes, yeah, I'm great. You know, I'll just riff with you, Mark. And I'm like, okay, that sounds good. I get out there and it's Teddy's turn and he fucking killed. And I was sitting right next to him watching it happen. And it was glorious. It was great. It was a great experience to watch Teddy kill with that old act, that good act, those dark ass jokes for a crowd that didn't know who he was. And it was just, it was really a beautiful thing. Really was a beautiful thing. Right now, it's my pleasure to bring on a guy that is legendary. He's one of the funniest fucking guys that ever lived. I haven't seen him in about 20 years. I didn't know if he was still alive or he would make it even. When I used to see this guy wandering around town when we were both drunks, I would show up in a room and he'd go, oh, look, the marinated man. The marinated man is here. Teddy Bergeron, ladies and gentlemen.
Marinated man, and you're doing well.
I'm doing all right, Teddy.
Yeah, it's terrific. Boston.
Yeah.
I love Boston.
Yeah?
Well, you love Boston.
Sure.
Everybody loves Boston.
Absolutely, Teddy.
I'll be like on the road.
Yeah.
I'll be working in Texas or Florida.
Yeah.
I mentioned I'm from Boston. There's always someone, oh, really? I'm from Boston, too. And I'm like, oh, really? What part? Maine.
I fucking so glad to see you, man.
Well, it's good to see you, Mark, and I'm glad you're doing well. I really am.
Yeah.
I'm so surprised. Not surprised. Okay. Anyway, look. Yeah. Hey, look at the energy you bring here.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because energy is important, Mark.
Yeah, it is.
You know that in comedy, in life.
Yes.
Life is, we live in a duality. It's positive, negative energy.
Yeah, right.
Back and forth, we fight with it.
Yeah.
Happens to me. I see a woman.
Yeah.
Positive energy. She wants me.
Yeah.
Then the negative energy comes in. Yeah. Well, what a beautiful woman like her want with somebody like you?
Yeah.
Then the positive returns. Maybe she's an idiot. Because negative energy is no good for comedy.
Yeah.
We're in the theater district. Peter Pan, they play, I saw the sign.
Yeah.
I went to see Peter Pan on Broadway.
Yeah.
There's always some guy in the crowd that will want anybody to have fun, right?
Right.
Okay?
Yeah.
And all the kids are excited. And Sandy Duggan played, you know, Peter. She took a bow and she flew above the crowd. And all the kids are like, oh, look at her fly. Look at her fly. There's always that jerk in the back in a deep voice. Yeah. She's on a wire. She's not flying. She's on a wire. There's no Santa Claus and she's on a wire. She's flying. She's not a wire. It's going to break. She'll land on you. You'll die. How would you like to be an Olympic performer?
Yeah.
They perform in front of those guys that never, the sportscasters. Yeah. Are they a little negative, a little critical?
Yeah.
Because you watch like a diver.
Yeah.
And he's off the board.
Yeah.
And he backflips into a double somersault.
Yeah.
And he spins out of that to the left and the right, upside down, triple cartwheel into the water. You're like, wow. And you hear, Now that's a shame.
Oh, God, it's good to see you.
I'm up for this, man. When I heard you would do it, I got up for it.
Yeah, I'm so fucking great. It's hard to. I had to track you down. You're not easy. You know, they have websites and phones now.
Well, actually, I got a pass for the night. Yeah. And I have to go back to, you know. I talked to the doctors and let me out for a couple of hours.
You know what? I fucking believe that. I remember you used to talk about your father a lot.
Well, he was a negative guy too. No faith in me.
No kidding.
Oh my God. No matter, Christmas morning, what a happy time for a kid. I'd have my new toy. I'd run across the room, show it to daddy, and he'd smile and say, "Let's see you bust it now." And I get all freaked out and dropped it, you know. No matter what. You know, I'd be at the dinner table and ask for a glass of milk. Yeah, spill all over the table. You know, he used to announce my Little League games.
No.
Oh, yeah, he did the play-by-play over the air.
Yeah.
That was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
It's a fly ball, a deep center field, going back for us. My son, watch him drop it. He dropped it. Now watch the little son of a bitch. He's going to kick it around for half an hour and then throw it right into the fucking stand. You're leading me into some good stuff.
you ever look at your horoscope?
My horoscope. Well, I'm a cancer. That's because you look at the other ones.
Yeah.
You know, Aquarius, take a vacation. You deserve it. This is your year. You know, Sagittarius, you've worked hard. You know, you should relax. Good things are happening for you. Cancer, buy a shotgun. Place your mouth over the barrel and pull the trigger. You owe it to yourself and your friends.
Teddy Bergeron, ladies and gentlemen. That was beautiful. You feel good?
I had fun. I love it. All right. My hometown.
Love those jokes. I still laugh at those jokes. Rest in peace, Teddy Bergeron. You were the real deal, man. Okay. Keith Richards. So here's what we're doing. This first chat I had with him last week on Zoom. It's about 15 to 20 minutes. And I got the opportunity to talk to him again because we did good the last time. He's re-releasing the Main Offender album, which is his second solo album. It's the 30th anniversary reissue. It comes out this Friday, March 18th. You can get it on all the streaming music platforms. You can get it as a deluxe CD or vinyl release or as a super deluxe box set, which includes unreleased live recordings, an 88-page book, guitar picks, stickers, and more. And you can order that one at keithrichards.com. That's the one I got. It's fucking beautiful. And here's the deal. After this talk, the one I just did last week, we're going to go ahead and play the full 2015 interview I had with Keith in New York City. Now, that was I was beside myself. I was literally almost out of my body with excitement and just joy to sit with one of my heroes. And I thought, you know, in the last 6 years, 7 years, that maybe I'd gotten my shit together. I'd grounded myself a little bit. I could be a little more professional. But you'll hear going into this interview that I did last week, that was not the case. Equally as excited, only this time I think I busted his balls a little bit. I did try and get some laughs. Nothing more fun than making Keith Richards laugh. There's a few things more fun, but it's pretty great. It's pretty great. So this is me talking to Keith Richards last week on Zoom.
Hey. How you doing?
Good. How are you, man?
Fine. How you been, man?
It's good. I haven't talked to you in a while. You remember I talked to you a few years ago.
I do remember. How you been? Yeah.
I'm good.
We shared a cigarette.
Exactly. We were at the NPR studios, and they were all freaking out because we were smoking.
I gave it up.
Did you? Really? For real?
It's a couple of years, man.
Oh, my God. Do you feel, you got to feel better, right?
I didn't notice anything, man, until I started rehearsing for the Stones tour. And then when I started working, I realized I had a lot more air in the lungs and in the voice and more stamina. Yeah.
Yeah, but, man.
You know, it ain't all it's cracked up to be, you know.
What, not smoking?
Yeah. Better than the alternative, man, you know.
Sure, sure. You want to try and stay on this side of the grass for as long as possible.
Yeah, yeah. I'm working on that. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I'm sorry about your friend, man. I'm sorry about Charlie. He's terrible.
Oh, man, that was, that was a blow out of nowhere. But, what a guy.
Yeah. Yeah. How do you deal with that? Do you got a way, you've lost a lot of friends lately. You just kind of just deal with it?
I don't know. Yeah, it deals with you in a way. When that happens, the guys, keep cropping up when you least expect them to start. I've had a couple of chats with Charlie,
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that's nice. So you get a lot of people who bring you memories.
Yeah.
Oh, that's nice. I saw you guys in Florida, I think the last American show.
Oh, Miami.
Yeah, in Fort Lauderdale. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I was there. I visited my mother and Fran. I talked to Fran. I'm like, I want to go see the guys. And I went with my brother. It was fucking great. Now, I got to ask you a question, though. You go into Midnight Rambler, and then all of a sudden, unless I'm hallucinating, you went into Hellhounds on My Trail. Is that right?
We do throw a bit of Robert Johnson in. Yeah. Yeah, Mick and I have been fiddling around with that and just to sort of tail it off,
I couldn't believe it. I was out of my mind. It was the best thing. Because, I wait for Midnight Rambler every time I see you guys, and all of a sudden you're doing Hellhounds on My Trail, and I'm like, what the fuck is happening? It was great.
That middle bit is always left sort of open, and it's been going that way lately,
And you guys just come up with that yourself when you were rehearsing?
Yeah. I think one time Nick said something about Hellhound on My Trail, and I played the lick, and then we threw it in. He said, well, man, that fits really nice.
That was so good. And you played that, you put the capo on the 7th fret in just a regular tuning?
Regular tuning.
Yeah.
Regular tuning, 7th fret, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I figured out how to play it finally. I got another question for you. Hold on.
There's a little trick to it.
Oh, yeah? Where? You see this? Where can I have that hat?
Oh, that one. Yeah. You want that one? I got it around the corner, man.
I was like, where the hell is he getting these beanies,
I don't know, man. My daughters and wife get them off the, I know, online somewhere.
Oh, man.
That's all I know. Somewhere up there.
Here's another thing I got. Hold on. You see this thing? That's that French photo show by that Dominique Tart.
Dominique Tart, yeah. He was a friend of mine when we were cutting Exile.
Right. Well, I don't know where I saw it or somebody sent it to me, but I got the book, from the gallery. And it's like a family album, for God's sakes. It should be called Parenting with Keith Richards. There's so many pictures of you and Marlon on the boat hanging around, and then you in the basement playing guitar.
Yeah, that basement, man. Wow.
You remember it?
All very well, man. Yeah, too clearly. Yeah, it was rough down there in the summer, man. But it was worth it.
Oh yeah, I definitely think so. So look, man, this reissue of this record of Main Offender, I've listened to it. They sent me the box, and it's beautiful, man. Beautiful box. And I'm not a big collector guy, but all the pictures are great, and all the you got the photos and the handwritten lyrics and the drawings, and everything is just beautiful, and it sounds great. Now, who decides to do this? Does someone come up to you and say, it's time to do this? Or do you say, let's fucking do this?
Actually, Jane Rose, my manager, comes up and says, they want to reissue, and we got involved with really great sort of box set designers and stuff.
Wow, man, it's like an art book.
Yeah. What I like particularly about this Main Offender one is that it's also a live show thrown in
from London,
which was
it's a great show.
I didn't even know that was we'd recorded that tour, but so it was a good surprise for me too.
You didn't know they had the machine on.
No, man. I probably just forgot.
Yeah.
Well, it seems like there's a lot of that around where there's just all these tapes of bands, and I'm like, who the hell knew that they recorded this? But I guess someone flips it on.
We recorded it ourselves. It was myself that had forgotten that we'd done that. Because right after that, the Stones went back into full pelt.
What was that, Voodoo Lounge? Who's in the lineup on the live show? Is it the same lineup as on Main Offender?
On the live one, the bass would change to Jerome Smith. Anyway, that's what happened. Otherwise, all the same people. Bobby Keys, Ivan Neville, Bobby. Waddy Wachtel.
I was looking at the, I've listened to Words of Wonder four times. I mean, you really sang the shit out of that thing. And that was, it seems like that it'd been a while since you'd done a reggae song. Do you still listen to reggae now?
I do. I listen to the old classic reggae quite a lot. In fact, I just got back from Jamaica. That ain't playing reggae down there anymore.
What's going on down there now, man?
The usual, just about, the usual funk rap.
Hip-hop,
yeah.
Well, it's weird, because I think I have that that box set. I don't even know who put it out, that Wingless Angels box set, where it sounds like you're in a cave with a bunch of dudes.
That's about it, yeah.
So what was it like playing with Steve on the tour? You guys said a lot of nice things about Charlie, but what's the dynamic, in terms of how he plays different than Charlie?
Steve, very canny, man. Because he can play like Charlie Watts, but he didn't, at the same time, he was trying to do a mix of how Charlie approaches things but throwing in his own thing at the same time. And he's a master, man. He slotted in immediately. The whole band sort of responded and very simple. Mind you, we have been playing a lot. We all know each other. Steve's no stranger to the Stones. But it slotted in as, how you wish, what you hope for, you got. And it was great,
Yeah, it sounded good to me.
Yeah, man, good energy, good feel. And, considering the circumstances with the COVID and everything, a great tour,
Oh, yeah, it was great. Yeah, in Florida, they didn't give a fuck about COVID, it seemed. I'm surprised none of you guys got COVID in Florida. You managed not to get it, huh?
Yeah, we're careful, man. We've run a very pro tight ship, in under circumstances like that. Our whole crew, that's how you get through these things. Otherwise, bump.
Yeah, and you're feeling pretty good, huh?
Mm-hmm.
The last time I talked to you is 2015, and I'm not going to take any credit for anything, but I mentioned that you really need to do a blues record. And, within a year, you did a blues record. So, I'm not going to think that I had anything to do with that. But you can tell me.
Huh? It was being cut, when you were talking about it.
It was?
Yeah, because we cut it over a period of time, that 15, 16.
I got to tell you.
You're on the same. That's what I was saying.
Right. It's a great fucking record, Keith. It's a great fucking record.
Yeah, it's the stuff, as is. And I really liked it, man.
Because what's amazing about it is true, and this, right? So, really, anyone can play blues. I sit here and play them, right? But that's what you guys came from, and that's what you aspire to. So the to do it 50 years later, to do a record that could have been the song list of your first record, and just the way you guys own that music, and it's uniquely the Stones playing blues. It's it's such a gift. Oh, thank you. Yeah, sure. And I loved it. I loved it. I listen to it all the time, man. I tell people about it. I'm like, because for some reason, I'm like, you don't know about Blue and Lonesome. I'm like, I gotta spread the word that you guys made a fucking blues record that is just because you're a blues band.
Yeah, that's how it started, man. Yeah.
Are you gonna do another one? Another blues record?
It can come up just like that. So I'm not cutting it out at all. It could happen, but I'm not saying we're planning one right now, but blues records sort of happen in a studio when everybody's in like a dead period and somebody picks up and starts playing that stuff.
Yeah.
And then before you know it, you're cutting, you know.
I just love it, man. And I just like, who was it? Don Was? Did he wrangle you guys?
Yeah.
And how do you come, like Little Rain? I mean, hardly anyone knows that Jimmy Reed song. And you guys, like, and it sounded great, dude. How'd you figure it out?
And Bill, we were just playing our favorites, man. Little Rain was always a favorite of ours way back in '62, and we were
really
playing. Yeah.
And then Eric's on one, and what, he was just down the hall or something?
Yeah, he dropped by, yeah, for I forget which song. He was playing Slide.
Yeah. That's so wild, man. I can't believe that record. And okay, because I've been listening to, I just watched a documentary on Howlin' Wolf, and holy shit, that guy was amazing.
Yeah, he was. I've been reading about him, funnily enough, and how Sam Phillips found him.
Oh, right? Yeah. Are you reading that Sam Phillips autobiography?
Yeah, well, it's not auto, but it's Peter, what's his
Guralnik.
Name?
Yeah.
One, yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's a great book. That guy's a smart guy.
Oh, yeah, we did a TV show with Wolf on the West Coast, 1964, I think. That's where we met him, yeah. And also, he recorded some stuff in London.
Were you on that? Is there a Bill and Eric?
I wasn't on that, but the Stones, Charlie was, and I think Bill Wyman.
Steve Winwood, Eric Clapton, I think. Yeah, that's a pretty good one. That's a pretty good record.
Yeah,
man. Do you ever talk to Bill? You ever say hi or what?
Yeah, I saw him last time I was in London a year ago. Yeah. He's all right, man. The same old.
So what's the big plan, man? So this record's gonna come out now after you do a tour, like you just got off of. Like now, usually when it's over, have you had enough of Mick for a little while? Is that?
No, absolutely not true. As I told you, I've been in Jamaica. Yeah. I was in Jamaica with Mick. We spent a week together putting material together and just hanging around, you know. So
that's I love hearing that. That's nice. Everybody's so nice. Look at you. You're getting older and everyone's a nice guy.
It's a nice year.
So what are you putting together, Stones material?
Yeah. Steve Jordan was down there too, and
So you got some songs going.
Oh yeah, yeah. That was the idea. That's what happened. Yeah.
How many you got down?
Man, I really can't count more than I can count. Actually,
no,
it was a very prolific week.
That's fucking great news, man. So you just sit around with the guitars and go?
Yeah, no, we had a set up there, everything, bass drums and all that. We got a pretty good sound going.
Is it different?
Yeah. No, Jamaica's good for sound. Because
that's what I notice about Main Offender is that, it's pretty timeless. It doesn't, you didn't do any weird production things. It's sort of there. And it's like all the songs are just, great Keith Richards songs. They just hold up.
Yeah, what it is.
So what's the plan with the new music? Is it mostly like a Stone sound? Are you trying anything new?
Everything takes on. I was playing a lot of bass, so it was taking on a sort of another angle.
Oh.
But it's quite interesting.
Oh,
but,
good.
At the same time, it's Stones, and it's Stones,
right? Right.
Yeah. That's the way it is, but it was great fun.
Yeah.
And, we're gearing up. I presume or I hear that we're playing Europe very shortly.
Holy shit! So how, like, you're going to go out again? Do you love it?
Once a year, I love to keep the hand in, and there's nothing like it playing on stage.
Oh, yeah. So great. It's so great. Like, I like how, I like, everybody's got a different, you know, like, it's funny that all of you guys are, well, you know, you and Ronnie and Mick anyways, are sort of like, you're sort of aging into an almost newer timing with each other, you know? Like, they're just something that happened naturally. It's so beautiful because who do you know? Ooh. Like, first of all, you know, you look great because, you know, you decided on a beanie and you stopped, you know, weaving your hair and with beads. And I like that, but, you know, the beanie's nice. Clean look.
Something to do.
but everybody looks great. So how's Ron doing? How's Ronnie? Good?
Ron, very good. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we were in touch with him in Jamaica via the phone, you know. Yeah, he's getting ready for the tour, man.
All right. Just, you know, all right. Well, that sounds fucking great. And I hope you do another blues record. Throw a blues cover on that new record.
And okay,
And take care of yourself. It's always great seeing you. And I really, like, I loved listening to this record again. And as I said, you know, I'm not a big box set guy, but Jesus, this thing is beautiful. It's beautiful. You can just sit there and look at the picture. Oh, I remember. There's pictures in here. What's with the Strats? I don't think I've ever seen you with a Strat. There's pictures of you.
Yeah, no, it's every now and again, you know. It depends on the song, you know. Yeah.
You like that P90 sound recently, though, right?
Yeah.
That's that dirty sound. It sounds great, man. Yeah, but I love it, man. Love you. Love seeing you. Glad you're well.
My love. Okay, Mark. Thanks.
Yeah, man. Take it easy, man. Yeah,
you too.
Fucking Keith Richards, man. All right, look. What, it's so fun. It's so fun. I got to get that beanie, though. You can order the box set from KeithRichards.com, okay? And someone tell me, listen, I'm serious about the beanie. I want to know where to get the beanie. I want to know where to get the beanie. All right, here's the full interview that we did at the NPR studios in New York in 2015. That was where he was talking in the Morning Edition. I just kind of piggybacked on. And I smoked a cigarette. Keith Richards got me to smoke a cigarette. I knew what I was getting into. Hey, man. Nice to meet you.
Pleasure, man.
Wow. Let's do it.
Okay. We're on.
We're on. I got my nicotine candies. You got yours?
Oh, baby, yeah. Right here.
You got the real ones. Oh, I miss the Marlboro Reds.
Yeah.
I actually thought about smoking. I thought if there was a time to start again, it would be with you.
Yeah.
Hey, my gosh. Let me just hold one. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You can just look at it if you like.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, man.
What are we drinking this afternoon?
Nuclear waste.
Oh, perfect. That's good.
Yeah.
You've adapted to it. No problem.
I'm ahead of the game.
Yeah. I figured you'd drink nuclear waste. You have to, right? Just to keep going?
No, just to talk to you.
I'm dying to figure out whether I'm going to light this fucking cigarette. You know what's interesting? Let's see
if you can hold out.
Okay, I'll try. It's been about a decade, but I think I talked to you briefly on the phone. I don't know if you remember. Maybe I'd like to think you would remember. We talked. I told you that I started smoking because of you. I started drinking because
of you. Oh, you're the one.
I'm the one. Good one. That's good. But it was funny because I remember reading an interview with you, and they asked you what kind of cigarettes you smoke, and you said, well, Newport, sometimes Marlboro Reds. So I was about 14, and I went out and got a pack of both and just, you know, played it out, see what stuck.
Yeah, I don't know where they got the Newports from.
You never said it. Never tried it.
Marlboro Reds, yeah.
Yeah, right? Well, whatever. I was walking around with both in high school trying to figure out how to be Keith Richards.
Oh, man.
Yeah, it was a rough few years.
But like, I was in school trying to figure out how to be Keith Richards, too. Strange, isn't it?
You figured it out. Well, you're like, I interviewed the president a few weeks ago, and I'm actually a little more frazzled about this because, you know, presidents come and go, but, you know, you're Keith Richards, you remain forever.
Yeah, that's sort of one of the blessings.
You're like royalty, man.
Oh, I don't know about that. I've no crown.
Yeah? Are you sure? I think you do. I think you do. Well, this is like I'll get through the nerves in a minute, but it's a big deal to meet you because you're a big idol of mine. Now, do you, when you started playing and you guys started to, you know, sort of come into your own, do you remember the first idol of yours that you met?
Oh, Little Richard.
Really?
Yeah. And Bo Diddley.
Really?
Yeah, because we were thrown onto this tour. I mean, before that, we'd been working clubs, you know. I mean, suddenly we had a record. And we were thrown on this tour with Little Richard, Bo Diddley, and the Everly Brothers. Uh-huh. And so I suddenly met, you know, half of my...
childhood.
Mentors. And, all in one. And I'm working with them, too, you know, which was an amazing education. I mean, that's a university for me.
Uh-huh. Did you talk to Bo? Did you ask him questions?
Yeah. We were on the road for like 3 or 4 weeks.
Really?
You know? Yeah. I used to take care of Jerome Green, was his maracas player.
Uh-huh.
And Jerome was a great lush.
Yeah.
And it was my job to get him out of the pub, to get him on stage.
It's funny, I think those roles changed later in life.
I was willingly happy to do it. You know, I mean, because Jerome was a loose cannon, and, you know, somebody had to do it.
Right.
So we ended up becoming great buddies, and Bo. Little Richard was amazing to watch.
Yeah.
His stagecraft, let alone his music. I mean, he had an English band with him, which they weren't bad.
A pickup band?
Yeah, basically. But they were pretty good. But I mean, I'd have wished he had his own band with him, but at the same time, man, the way he would, you never knew where he was going to appear from.
Right.
I mean, he'd let that band play Lucille, let the riff.
Right.
For like 5 minutes, you know, nonstop.
Right.
In total darkness, you know. Dun, 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 dun. And then he'd turn up in the back of the auditorium, you know, with the spotlight on him.
And walk through the crowd?
Yeah, and then walk through. And I did, wow, the way you can work a room, man, I'm learning things.
Right. you almost been learning things.
And the Everly Brothers, I mean, so meticulously beautiful.
Those harmonies, right? Wow.
Yeah.
And you were with him for like 3 weeks you did that tour?
Yeah, 63.
So that was before England's Newest Hitmakers or around the same time?
It had just come out about the same time. Yeah.
When was the last time you listened to that record?
The odd track, around again. Yeah.
It's a weird thing because, like, I listened to that record a lot, you know, and I came to the Stones like much later because I mean I'm 51,
yeah,
so I was picking
youngster.
It up, right? But that record, I played the shit out of that record. To me, that was, you know, that was the pure intention, the birth of it all.
Yeah, in a way, I guess it was for us anyway, and it was recorded in this little room that professed to call itself a studio.
Yeah.
The whole walls were covered in egg boxes. That was called soundproofing.
Right, first class, yeah, top notch.
And it was a Grundig two-track, but it was hung on the wall.
Yeah.
Instead of, if it was on the table, it would have looked like, you know, unpro. But it's hung on the wall.
Give it a professional feel.
Yeah, man, but we cut the whole damn thing on that, you know. And it was, so I started on two-track, really.
Right.
Basic.
Yeah. Did you do Honest I Do?
Yeah.
Is that on that one?
Yeah.
Can I Get a Witness?
Can I get a witness, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Tell me.
Tell me, yeah, yeah. And like that, you set out to be a blues band.
Yeah.
Right?
That was the intention.
Pure. Yeah. Straight up.
Yeah.
And at that time, you know who I talked to? I don't know if you guys are friends or not. A couple of weeks ago, I talked to Richard Thompson. And
We're not friends because I hardly ever see him. I don't know, but I know the man.
I think he was a little younger, but he was talking about the scene in London at that time. There were so many bands, and you guys would all see each other late at night, like at restaurants, and see each other play all the time. And what was the scene you were involved in? It was all blues, right?
Yeah, I mean, we were strictly at that time, at the beginning of the Stones, strictly. We were almost Jesuits. Well, let's say missionary.
Uh-huh.
But no, our whole aim was to turn London on to, like, you know, rhythm and blues on the blues. And
right.
That was like the scope for the whole universe would be.
Right.
That, you know, and to have 3 or 4 or 5 gigs a week. And, you know, and that would be, you know, that's it. You know,
who were your guys early on? Who were the dudes that you were the most trying to emulate on the guitar? Like before Chuck, the straight up blues dudes.
Right, T-Bone Walker.
Oh, yeah.
And Muddy Waters, too, right. Very simply, Buddy Guy.
Yeah. Slim Harpo, or is that later?
And yeah, Slim Harpo, man.
Jimmy Reed.
Jimmy Reed was hard on Jimmy Reed.
Yeah.
Because we were not so much interested in being virtuosos. I mean, it was how those guys got that sound.
Right, right.
And to us, it was the thing of trying to get close to making that kind of sound.
Yeah, yeah.
And we studied, man.
What, you and Brian?
We studied and starved.
Yeah. What was Brian's thing? What was he into most? Were you both
Brian,
in the same thing?
Brian, very big into Jimmy Reed.
Okay, yeah, so very, that's where that came from. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, so Mick and I were also into him, but Brian had the records.
Right,
so,
right.
You know, we didn't, you know, Mick had the Muddy Waters, and I had the Chuck Berry. Brian had the Jimmy Reed.
Okay, all right.
So, I mean, there was an obvious collection, you know, and a connection. But Jimmy Reed stuff, I still think, is some of the most beautifully recorded stuff, and it's so simple.
Yeah, he plays it. He does a weird thing right on the five. He leaves that open.
Because if you're playing an E, when he's playing the five chord, he lets the three chord, the seventh note, still hang.
Right, he leaves the A open, right?
He leaves it open. I learned that from Bobby Goldsboro.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean,
he hipped you to that bus.
He hit me to that because he'd been on the road with Jimmy Reed. So he hipped me to, you know, the weird thing that makes that sound is like he does this.
Yeah.
He leaves the open A string going, you know. Oh man, I've been trying to get that for years. I would never have figured it. You know.
Oh, it's funny how those moments happen. I mentioned they must have been a few of those moments, like when you were putting together your chops, where you're like, "Oh fuck, that's how that goes."
Yeah. Are you kidding me? I mean, you keep looking. You know, how did he pull that lick off?
Right.
You know, I mean,
even with Chuck, when you did that fucking movie with him.
Yeah, man. Bless his heart.
We had the argument about the beginning of O'Carroll.
Yeah.
That was touch and go, man.
Well, that was him testing me out, you know, and pushing. Chuck always has to be numero uno.
Right.
You know, after all, the movie's about Chuck.
Right.
To me, I'm living my childhood dream of being second guitar behind Chuck Berry, you know what I mean?
Yeah. You never knew what a pain in the ass that would be, I guess.
No. I tell you what, at the same time, he's a funny guy. I mean, mercurial.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
1 minute, he's grouching, and then he'd piss off for half an hour.
Yeah.
And he'd come back, and he'd be
back on top.
Did he take a hit or something? he was a great mood changer, but incredible to work with. And I think my best feat out of that was when I said to Chuck Berry that Johnny Johnson's still around, because Ian Stewart, who had just died that year, who was the Stones piano player.
From the beginning.
I mean, actually, I consider the Stones to be Ian's band.
Really?
Yeah. He put it together.
Really?
He poured us together. Without him, we wouldn't have coagulated.
Uh-huh.
And
he only got pushed. He stopped being in the main lineup because what happened?
Oh, well, he wasn't good looking enough, and it was like they thought six was too many.
Okay.
Stu, having the largest heart in the world, said, "Yeah, I understand that. That's cool." But we recorded. It was still his band.
He
became our roadie, our manager, road manager, and everything, take care of everything. so I think that Ian Stewart considered us his baby, and I consider him my dad.
Oh, that's sweet. But so your relationship with Ian sort of made you reach out and find Johnny.
Yeah, because the last thing that Ian Stewart ever told me is, and this was just before he died, he said, "Don't forget, Keith, that Johnny Johnson is alive and playing in St. Louis."
Right. Ian said that to you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And within a year, I'm working with Chuck Berry. Yeah. And I'm saying, you know, in my mind, I'm saying to myself, well, without Johnny Johnson, it's never going to be the same. So I say to Chuck, "Hey, Chuck, Johnny around?"
Yeah.
And Chuck comes with a very deadpan vision. He's in town. Any chance of getting him together on this thing? I'll give him a call.
Yeah.
And the next day there was Johnny, and then I realized I had
the band,
the stuff.
Yeah.
And I realized that I had the stuff that had actually made Chuck's records and
sounds so good. And,
yeah.
And that he literally learned how to play those licks from Johnny's piano playing.
Yeah.
That Johnny was first.
Yeah, actually, yeah.
And that, it's weird when I watch that movie, because I've been a fan of yours my whole life, but I'm not sure I necessarily understood, you know, how complicated the rhythm of Chuck Berry is, and how you deconstructed that to get your shit.
Yeah, it's a variation on the theme, but Chuck and I basically play the same. It's basically the role.
Right.
You know, it's syncopation.
Right.
And for that, you need a drummer that you can totally rely on, you know.
Yeah.
And which is, unfortunately for Chuck, once he'd used pickup bands for...
Went away.
Yeah, because he couldn't rely on the drummer,
right.
And they were just bands he'd never met, you know.
Right.
Which was unfortunate in that respect. But
because there's a bounce to it.
But I've no doubt Chuck walked out with the money.
In a briefcase.
Yeah.
In a Cadillac.
Oh, I know that briefcase.
But that's it. That's a bounce. It's a bounce, right?
It's a cut against the beat, you know.
Right.
But the drummer has to be right on for you to be able to chop the beat around and move it and make it roll.
Yeah.
That's the roll in the rock. You know?
And that, right. And that's Charlie.
Yeah.
Solid.
Can I count on that man or what?
You know, yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah. You know, I imagine you know, but yeah, I think what was it, Abco reissued a few of the old ones.
Yeah.
They reissued Get Your Yayas Out, right? So yeah. I used to listen to that shit in high school, right? And I put on the reissue. And I had this moment in my living room where I'm like, holy fuck! Bill and Charlie are holding this whole thing together right now.
Yeah.
Did you?
Hey, nothing like a good rhythm section.
Like, until I heard that remaster and the way you guys were all fitting together, I was like, Jesus, man, that's so solid. But I don't know why. I think in the live situation, I think Mick even said something about it, that they were nailing it that night. Do you have memories of those nights in particular that you recorded?
Man, you know, when you're on stage, no, quite honestly, no, because I'm not thinking about we're being recorded or filmed, which is even worse, because people get aware of the cameras and they start to tighten up.
You know, no tightening up.
I try and forget all about what's going on around me.
Yeah.
Just do the gig.
Yeah. Yeah, I saw you in San Diego, I went. Just now, the first night of the tour.
Yeah. It got better and better, too. And that was a good show. I mean,
it was a good show. It was a great show. I was nervous. I was nervous for you. I don't know what the hell.
I love you.
I hadn't been to see you in a long time. I saw you guys in 81 at Madison Square Garden when, I guess it was probably the Tattoo U tour, and Screaming Jay Hawkins opened for some reason.
Oh, yeah.
I think James Brown was supposed to. And then something happened. I don't know what happened. But
I don't know, probably didn't like Screaming Jay.
Yeah, I don't know, but it was just weird. Screaming Jay comes out with the voodoo stick. Yeah. I don't even think he had a fucking band with him. And everyone in Madison Square Garden's like, what's happening? And then you guys came out, and I didn't go see you because, I don't know, it was strange for me when Bill left. Was it strange for you?
Absolutely. I was furious. I sent out the hitmen. Except I love him so much.
Yeah.
I can't go that far.
Yeah.
You know, I'll just break your legs.
Yeah. Right.
No, but it was a hard call, man.
Yeah. He'd tire out?
Yeah, he's and also he developed this fear of flying.
Oh, really?
So he was like driving to every gig, which is like, you know, sometimes they were so far, but you know.
Right.
And eventually he decided, it was his decision.
Yeah, yeah.
To call it the day. And I said, you kidding me, man? You know,
what are you gonna do, right?
You know, you were in the RAF in 1956.
Yeah, right.
Schlepping around in Germany.
Yeah,
and no, he was adamant, and he made his decision, and maybe it was right for him.
Right,
you know. And all I can say is that, I get Darryl Jones.
Yeah, yeah. He was great. It was great. It was the first time I'd seen you guys in a long time. And like I said, I was nervous because I hadn't seen you in 35 years. And man, what a fucking, you sounded great. And I mean, there was moments there where, you know, there.
We've improved over time.
Yeah, you've gotten good. I think you're really tight right. You're good right now.
I'm going to take it up.
Yeah. But I, the experience of it was, like when I, there was moments where Mick was running, you know, running back and forth. Do you ever like at the point where you guys are at now, you know, I mean, we're mature gentlemen. You're a little more mature than me. Do you have moments where you're like, I hope he doesn't fall the fuck down?
Oh, no, I never worry about, no, Mick is so nimble, man. And
it's crazy.
I mean, Charlie is, and I always watch Mick in case, when you get out
in
the audience that you're not hearing the beat.
Right, right.
Same as it actually is. But we're actually experts. Like, he's crossed the beat. Okay.
And we can. You changed the mic?
Yeah, yeah. We're like a safety net under Mick. He doesn't realize it, probably. But, I mean, Charlie and I always like, well, he's not. You know, okay.
We got it. We got him.
We can actually do that. Yeah.
That's hilarious.
Yeah. Well, that's what the job of a band is, to like support the front man.
Yeah. Know? Yeah. And now when you got, you know, because when we talked before, you talk a lot about the band and your band and the band. But I have to assume that when you guys started out, you know, at the beginning, you were just a bunch of buddies, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And it just evolved into this
brought
thing.
Brought together by the music.
Right. You know? Who was the guy that you guys used to play with or play at his club when he started? Was it Alex Corner? Is that who it was?
Yeah, Alexis Corner.
Alexis Corner.
Yeah, yeah. The Ealing Club, yeah.
And
yeah.
He was like a blues impresario?
Yeah, he at the time probably had the blues nailed down in London.
Right,
If you wanted to hear blues, you had to see Alexis. He's the only guy playing it, basically.
Right,
you
know? Right.
And, also, he had Cyril Davis, who was a great harp player with him. And they were good. Alexis wasn't particularly, you know, that good. I remember Alexis one night invited us, Mick and me, up to do a number.
Yeah.
And Mick and I said, right, we're going to do Roll Over Beethoven.
Yeah.
Alexis, used to use a thumb pick.
Okay, know, yeah.
He cut his strings and, oh, I'll leave it to you.
And you just took it?
Yeah, no, yeah, he didn't want to play that rock and roll.
Oh, really? But, he's a real purist?
Well, kind of. You know,
yeah.
But also, I mean, he appreciated rock and roll and everything, but, I mean, he knew that he couldn't... He wouldn't be an addition.
Right. I'm gonna bow out on this one. Well, on the new record, you know, I listened to it like a couple of times.
Yeah.
Cross-Eyed Hearts, the name of the record, right?
Yeah.
So the first song, like I noticed, like you're going way back for that. I mean, that's pre-Jimmy Reed, that's pre-Muddy Waters, Robert Johnson.
That's Robert Johnson.
Because I noticed, like,
it's the tip of the hat to Robert Johnson.
It's like Hellhounds on My Trail, almost, man. It's like it's just a piece.
Yeah.
Like you can hear you breathing. You can hear, you know, every squeak of your fingers and every pick. You know, it's all very raw and organic. And then you're just sort of like, that's all I got. that's the riff. And no, it's not even, it's almost like a blues meditation.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I thought, you know, that would be, you know, when we got all the tracks together, if we're going to put that blues in, it might as well be the starter.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it's like, you know, when people walk into movies and they say, you know, the overture.
Yeah. It's sort of the subtle overture. And then you bookended it with Goodnight Irene, another blues, different style. more of a folk blues, but the on both sides you got some you got Lead Belly. Yeah, you got Lead Belly and Robert just holding it all in.
Yeah, I wanted to do a couple of classic American folk songs.
Right.
And the weird thing that happened is that Tom Waits had sent me big book on Lead Belly, and it had just arrived, and I just put it on the table.
Yeah.
And at the same time, a few hours later, in walks my guitar man, Pierre de Beauport.
How long you been with that guy? A million years, right?
Pierre, yeah. No, since early 90s,
yeah.
91.
Yeah.
And that, brilliant guitar. I mean, I'm lost without him, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, he decides which guitar I'm going to play on songs. That's how much I trust him. And he walked in with this 12-string. So I'm looking at this book of Lead Belly that Tom Waits has just sent me, and I'm looking at this 12-string, and I'm saying, I have no choice. I've been ordered to do Goodnight Irene.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. It's pretty haunting music, some of his stuff, huh?
Oh, yeah, Lead Belly was deep. And I found the original lyrics, you know, which are much...
I know, I didn't know them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're much raunchier than...
Right.
Because then it became, you know, you'd get the black and white minstrels singing it. I mean...
Right.
And it became like an American folk song.
Right,
people would waltz to it and stuff.
Nah, but it was kind of a dirty song.
The real show.
Yeah. So what, like, you got a guitar guy, this guy Pierre, but like you're pretty committed to like a handful of guitars. Like there's four or five that you play pretty much all the time.
Yeah, pretty much. When it comes down to work, yeah.
And I was watching, I was trying to figure it out on stage because I bought a Tele because of you way back when. Not a good one, but it, I had it. Yeah. I think you were on the cover of Guitar Player, but yeah, I think you had one that was altered. I don't remember. It had the rhythm pickup was regular, and then there was a humbucker, on the lead pickup.
We do screw around with them. we do rewire them.
Yeah.
And we do play around with the pickups on them. Yeah.
And you play that 54 all the time. That cream one, right?
Yeah.
For years.
Yes, yeah, boom, and bashing the hell out of it still, you know.
What do you go into, though? You're not a pedal guy now, are you? No pedals?
No.
Just straight in.
Hey, man, I mean, it's enough to stand up straight. Let alone poking around on buttons, you know.
So you just change the volume when you need to.
Yeah, and also any of those effects that I need actually can be done from behind. Pierre, if we need a little tremolo.
Yeah.
We do it from, because I need to know where to put my feet.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, tripping over those boxes.
Yeah.
It just ties you down.
Yeah. Now, what made you decide, because when I talked to you before, you guys were maybe going to do Sticky Fingers. You're going to run all three. But that died in one night. And the recording of it sounded great. So what made you the next night decide, like, no, we're not going to do it?
Well, I don't know, maybe Mick's a better one to ask on that, but he just thought, and I think we all thought that, doing it the whole thing once was enough, and we were, that actually was sweating our balls getting through it, you know.
Really?
But the whole album, you know.
Sure.
The hardest one to play and one of the most beautiful ones is I Got the Blues, which is so slow.
Yeah.
And it's very, the hardest thing for a band is to keep a slow tempo down. I mean, everything tends to speed up. So it has to be, you know, that Steve Gropper was great at that with Otis, you know.
Right.
And Al Jackson, the drummer, you know, with in Memphis.
But you guys didn't want to drop into that. I also noticed, I think that there's to be the greatest rock and roll band and the biggest rock and roll show, you know, you got to be big. You know what I mean? You did Moonlight Mile, which was beautiful. He hit those fucking notes. That was crazy.
I started to like playing that on the stage. At first, I thought, yeah, going out on a limb here, Mick. You know, it's a little sparse. But as we got into it, it was beautiful to play and great fun, and they were loving it out there.
Yeah. Speaking of Otis, I was thinking about, like, because you know he could lay back on that groove, but it's, I was thinking about, what did you, after you, Satisfaction was a hit, and then he decided to cover it. That must have been a big fucking day.
Yeah, that was put another crown on, baby. You know?
Yeah, right?
I mean, for one of our songs to be covered by one of the greatest R&B singers of all time, it was, let's die and go to heaven, or wherever. I know, because that was basically the cream on the,
right?
on the whole thing. And then Aretha did it, and then we were like in double heaven.
Yeah.
But, it was great to get that respect and that respond and reciprocation back from, hey, after all, he played black music.
Right.
And we're white as white can be.
Yeah, and he found that groove, though. Like, to make that a soul song was something, huh?
Yeah.
It was amazing.
And it was just amazing that these people that respected and admired so much would do one of our songs.
And then you played with, on this record, on the new record, you used Spooner Oldham, right?
Spooner's there, yeah.
And he played with Aretha on some of the big hits,
mm-hmm,
right?
Yeah.
Down in Muscle Shoals. So that must have been amazing to work with that guy. You'd worked with him before?
No, first time I've ever met Spooner, although I've known him, I feel like I've known him for years because he's been on so many records. It was actually Graham Parsons that first pointed out Spooner Oldham to me.
Really?
And that was in like 71 or 70.
He knew it. He felt it.
Graham knew country music, and Spooner was basically a country music player at that time.
Uh-huh.
I didn't even know that he was still around, and a couple of phone calls. Steve Jordan, bless his heart, the man I work with, and who co-wrote these songs with me and produced it,
great drummer,
fantastic drummer.
Been playing with him a long time on your solo stuff.
Yeah, I was turning. Charlie Watts said to me in about 85, 86, we knew the Stones were going to take a hiatus or hibernation or whatever you want to call it, and Charlie Watts said, if you're going to work with anybody else, Steve Jordan's your man.
Oh yeah?
Yeah. And I took him at his word. I listened to Charlie assiduously. Yeah. and Steve and I started to work together, and not only we just sort of worked together, we fell into each other's arms, and he was a great friend of mine.
That's great. Yeah, it's beautiful, man. Yeah, I mean, it's nice to walk into a studio with a bunch of dudes and trust, and we're going to make something.
And so, the Winos came together, Ivan Neville, man. Waddy Wachtel, who I can never
forever
praise.
You play with that guy.
I love that guy.
Long time, right? Great player.
Great.
Yeah,
simpatico.
Yeah, and this was the last record that Bobby Keys played on.
Unfortunately, yeah.
I'm sorry you lost your friend, man.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Yeah, hey, Bobby's probably laughing his head off. We had no idea that was going to be his last recorded stuff when we did it. But Bobby. Hey, that's Mr. Rock and Roll, man. Large as Texas, if not larger.
Between the two of you, it's like you're both Mr. Rock and Roll. He certainly lived the life.
He certainly did.
Yeah. Now, when you lose somebody that you've been with around with that long, but I guess at some point you realize that we're all living on borrowed time, and he certainly didn't waste any, right?
Right. No. They said, I ain't got no time to lose, baby.
Is that what he said? No, before you met Graham, though, you were into country music, but do you think Parsons really kind of blew your mind on it, or what?
It's just that I met Graham in London. He was actually with the Byrds at the time. They'd done Sweetheart of the Rodeo.
Yeah.
And they'd stopped in London and did a couple of gigs. And then they were destined to go play South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And I happened to bump into Graham that night. I went to see the show, and we got to talking after. And he said, I'm getting this sort of feeling, about South Africa. And I don't know, I don't understand it. I don't know. So I explained to him. He said, it's like going to the South, honey. But even worse. This is like, this isn't segregation, this is apartheid.
Mm-hmm.
And once he'd done this, he said, and he left the Byrds that day and stayed with me in London.
Oh, really? He just let them go on their own?
Yeah.
On principle?
Yeah.
Nah.
That's fucking beautiful.
Yeah. And they became very, very close friends. Had a few cold turkeys together.
Sweat it out.
Yeah.
That's sad, too. Yeah, that guy died so young.
Yeah, man. That's another one, you know.
But you still do, like, it's interesting, like, this record, it's got all the stuff that you love on it. You know, you've got your soul ballad. You know, you got your country music,
I got couple reggae, country songs.
The reggae, the reggae was really good, man. I was like, he's like doing reggae again, but you love it.
I've always loved it. I've lived in Jamaica for many years.
Yeah, you don't got that place anymore.
Oh yeah,
you still have it.
Mm-hmm. Oh. Yeah,
but at the time you got it though, didn't you have to get it? Like you couldn't come home, right?
I burnt the passport actually. Yeah.
Because someone sent me that box set that you did with those guys in the cave or something. What was that?
The Wingless Angels. Yes. Yeah, man. The Rastafarian.
Those recordings are crazy, man.
Yeah.
It's just like hours of I'm like, oh, there's Keith. I can hear a little Keith there, you know?
I'm just backing up.
Right, you know?
I was letting the guys have their
thing. It's wild, man.
Yeah, luckily, because nearly all of them have passed away since.
Oh, yeah. It's a nice box, that box.
Yeah, it's a great, it was a great experience, and it was sort of, just to capture some of the last moments of this particular part of Jamaican culture.
Yeah.
And I managed to do it.
Yeah.
And they loved it. We had great fun. I mean, you couldn't have funnier sessions in your life.
Yeah, yeah.
With that lot.
A lot of weed.
What do you want? A rum and milk.
Yeah. So in terms of, being at the age you're at now and in sort of the type of songwriting you're doing, because there's a couple of songs on here like on the new record, like Amnesia and Nothing on Me, like where I felt were sort of like, you know, celebrations of being still alive in a way. You know what I mean?
In a way, I guess. Everything is. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Nothing on Me is basically was about being busted.
Right, right.
And it wasn't until after you listened to the whole record that I realized that the cops crop up a lot in this record, on Rob Bland.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. Yeah. Well, you made it. You're not wanted anymore. You're good, right?
Yeah, and there's no warrants out.
You're set, you're solid. Yeah, well, let's talk about guitar players for a minute. Like, all right, so you lost Brian, and then you bring Mick in, then you toured with Mick a bit, Mick Taylor.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I guess my question, if I'm really going to focus it, just out of my own curiosity, because there was some shift where you guys sort of invented modern rock and roll. There was some shift, probably right in the middle or right after Satanic Majesties, where the entire sound and the groove became what the modern Stones are. What do you think, what happened to sort of make that happen? Was it? Was there a moment where you're like, "This is where it's at"? I mean, the difference between how you cover, "Love in Vain" or what you did with the blues and country music on "Let It Bleed" and "Beggars" in "Exile," it just that became the template for rock and roll from that point forward.
You know, in a way, I can put this in two words: Jimmy Miller,
producer.
Yeah. Yeah.
How did he affect that? How did he influence it? What did he say?
Well, after Satanic Majesties, we were, Mick and I were like, we have to refocus, man. And that was a mad year. I mean, there was Sergeant Pepper and Satanic Majesties. But, well, I guess they're all on acid, right? You know what I mean? Which is true enough.
So you did a little acid, the thing.
Oh, they've gone to India. Yeah.
So you had to keep up with the Beatles.
I mean, no, we had to refocus. And at that
time, that's interesting. So that was the end of you keeping up with the Beatles. You're like, we got to do our shit.
Yeah. I mean, I couldn't go anywhere near there. And I realized that the Beatles, the boys themselves, are sort of outpaced themselves in a way. You know, and they were,
Well, they lasted, that was it. They did
what are you going to do? What are you going to do? You know, numero uno, numero. And so they started to, like anybody else, to play around. But that was 67, 66, 67.
Right.
Those years were I mean, it was crazy. I mean, there was LSD all over the place.
Right.
And so if you made...
You know, did you like that shit?
I had a couple of good trips and a couple of bad ones, you know. Just like anything else, you
right,
know.
Right, right.
But no, it was not something that I'd wake up in the morning and sort of say, I must have a tab, you know.
Right, right, right. Because then what are you going to do for the next 3 days?
Yeah, no, it's crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
It was interesting.
Yeah.
And I mean, I don't say I don't regret any of it, but it was an experiment. And,
right.
But how I think, in a way, it kind of shook Mick and I up because we said, boom, now we really got to tighten up. You know, this is why we got Beggar's Banquet. And I got to say that Jimmy Miller was the key in tightening the band up and refocusing, so to speak.
Well, it seems like you guys, like you said about, you know, doing, you know, yeah, you want me to do it. About smoking that first cigarette in 10 years with Keith Richards. I don't know why I wouldn't do that. Thanks, man.
I'm a bad influence, man.
Not you, Keith. That sounds so not you. You're not a bad influence. So, but in terms of because when you talk about it, you know, I got the blues. You know, and that laid back thing. I mean, somebody, you know, relaxed the band. And if it was Jimmy Miller, how did he do that necessarily? You know what I mean? Get you into that groove. Because the sound is pretty different from Aftermath to fucking Beggars.
Yeah. It was, I think, after the Satanic Majesties, I think we'd actually reached the end of our tether. Mm-hmm. You know, we'd been working 350 days a year, man, for like 4 years. You know? I mean, there was, you know, where did you go on your vacation? Vacation? Yeah, forget about it.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
If we weren't in, on the road, we were in the studio. And I think, yeah, basically, even at that age, you know, we'd pretty much worn ourselves out. The year between that and bringing and getting Beggar's Banquet together was basically re-energizing, getting some rest, re-energizing and refocusing. And as I say, to me, it was Jimmy Miller that put the lens in the focus. You know, and so he was a drummer. He had a great sense of sound, and he loved the band.
Right,
you know, I mean, and he brought out the best in us.
And did Brian die in the middle of that?
Somewhere around there, yeah. Brian, I mean, he's the kind of guy you love to hate.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, he was
brilliant but annoying. Is that what you're saying?
Brilliant, and yes. beyond annoying. No, that motherfucker.
Yeah.
He would, you know, we'd be in Chicago and play a gig, and he'd get asthma. And he's got, I got to play 3 weeks in the Midwest without another guitar player. I
mean, so he's
thank God
fragile.
The girls were screaming loud enough. But, I mean, I'm trying to cover all bases.
Yeah.
And then I find out that he was out of the hospital the next day and like hanging around screwing groupies. And, excuse me, man, we need a little more dedication. Yeah. You know?
You need a guitar. You got a job.
Yeah.
You have a job. You know. You're in a band.
So it went kind of from there, you know. I mean, that he was, he became a drag.
Yeah, And then when Mick Taylor comes in, that was a whole different kind of guitar player, right? I mean, it's really interesting, the difference between, you know, like Taylor and Wood. But like Mick Taylor was like, he was a big part of the sound for a couple albums, huh?
He certainly was. I mean, a brilliant guitar player.
Yeah. How's he doing?
This for the last I saw of him, he's doing all right. He's a bit chubby. But that's his privilege, right?
Yeah.
But he plays great. And we worked together for a couple of years. But, you know, Taylor, you know, I mean, to me, I'm a guitar player. But, you know, on my own, I mean it doesn't interest me. My interest is in playing off of the other guy and together, because two guitars can sound like an orchestra
right.
if you do it right.
Right, and, play off
and,
each other.
And that's really what
you know,
as Ronnie and I, call it, the ancient form of weaving.
Right,
It's like where you don't know who's playing lead, who's playing rhythm.
That's what you did.
That it all switches through. You know,
and Mick Taylor was kind of his own dude, right?
Yeah. So I had to readjust for that.
And
at that same time, I just gotten into the five-string thing, so I was rearranging my sound. And
where'd you learn that?
I tell you what, Ry Cooder was the first cat that I learned it from. I saw playing it.
Yeah.
I didn't learn it because he wouldn't teach you anything. Ry keeps his secrets and bless his heart. But I'm still finding out, man. I mean, what you can do with it, because it's a whole different... But to me, it sort of reinterested me in playing guitar, because I, you know, it's pretty much at the end of my possibilities on just straight tuning. I'm not going to be Charlie Christian.
You accepted
and
that.
And I don't want to be. You know, but I, when I got to the Open G thing, I started to really research it. How to play a minor chord with Open G, you know. And you get all of these resonating notes and drone notes and stuff. That fascinate and still do, you know. So.
Well, that's what makes, that's the genius of Keith right there. Right. It's funny. You're talking about the Beatles. I can't believe I'm smoking my first cigarette in 10 years with Keith Richards in an NPR studio.
How about that?
Fuck everything. We're smoking an NPR. Yeah. When I, you know what album I love, that what song I love is when you play with George Jones.
Oh, on the Bradley Barn thing.
I fucking listen to that all the time, man.
I mean, that was a real honor for me.
Was it?
I mean, yeah, to work with George Jones. I mean, first off, Graham Parsons and I, you know, say, Graham Parsons, George Jones is like the. And he's the singer.
The greatest singer.
Amazing. He's there with, you know, Aaron Neville is another cat that can use the voice as if it's, you know, effortless and do anything with it. In fact, Frank Sinatra once said that he thought George Jones was the second best singer. I would take exception
to that. amazing voice
and a great guy, crazy as nuts in there. But
were you guys playing off each other in the studio at the same time?
Like that.
You feel it too, man. It has a beautiful song.
Darling, there's talk around town.
It's fucking great. And you played with you did a record with Jerry Lee.
Yeah, man. Jerry Lee is another great friend of mine.
Yeah, still?
Yeah.
He's still hanging in, huh?
Man, he's amazing, man.
I guess you old devils got to stick together a little bit.
I guess. We've had our tiffs and we've had our, you know, but no, Jerry and I, you know, it's sort of a recognition of similar souls.
Right, And you were able to play with Muddy? And you play when Buddy's still around, so you play with him sometimes?
Buddy was on the show with us in Minneapolis. Or Milwaukee.
Did you play with Wolf?
Howlin' Wolf, once on that Shindig TV show.
Oh,
I think we didn't actually play with him. No, I was there.
And you watched?
Yeah, I once woke up in his house.
How'd that happen?
Well, I don't know. I fell asleep at Muddy's. I woke up in Howlin' Wolf.
In Chicago?
It was some party or something, you know. They must have carried me from one on. What are we going to do with this white kid? I don't know. We're just taking with us.
What the fuck? There must have been a lot of lost weeks, Keith. There must have
been a few here and there. Here and there.
How do you level up? How do you manage? I mean, we don't need to get too far into it. You got pretty strung out for a few years.
Oh yeah.
And
deliberately, you know, it's an experiment.
Yeah, is that how you view it? An experiment for a few years.
Yes, I'm the laboratory.
When did you realize that the experiment was over?
It was going on too long.
Yeah,
You know, I mean, you've been threatened with, you know. 7 years hard time, you know.
That'll do it.
Yeah. Hey, I love my band more than I love the stuff.
Oh, good. Yeah. So you're able to just to taper off and get into a management system?
Boom. I just kicked it.
Yeah. And what a relief, huh?
Yeah. You know, like, I mean, I got sick of dealers and junkies, you know. Because that's, you end up in that stuff, you end up, and that's, you realize that the only people you're talking to are like, are they strung out cats?
That's right. Like, you're in a hotel room full of people you don't know.
Yeah,
who are
waiting for the man and all
right,
that.
Right, right.
And so it was, yeah, it was time to cut that out. And cut it.
You know what's scary about that is that if you're in a room full of five or six of those dudes or whoever that attracts, if you go down, if you fucking OD, you know what? You're going to be alone in that room.
Oh, yeah.
No one's going to fucking call the cops.
Tell
no
me
one's
about
gonna,
it.
Right?
Yeah, man.
Oh, shit, he's down. Let's
I've
go.
I've seen the bodies.
Yeah? Yeah. It's a scary fucking world. Oh, my God. I read I didn't realize you put out a new book that I downloaded to read on the plane, Gus and Me.
Oh, and yeah.
I read your children's book. I thought it would take a little longer. It took me 8 minutes, but yeah. I downloaded it.
It took me 4 minutes to read it.
And to write it.
Yeah.
But it's really a pretty book. I mean, did you ever think in your life that you would be a children's book writer?
No, you think, I mean, the idea came up. I thought, are you kidding me?
Right. Who came up with that idea?
The publishers of life,
yeah.
of my own book. They'd come up with this idea about, there was a chapter in there about my grandfather.
Uh-huh.
And they said, this could be a really like nice children's story, and I thought, if I'm going to write anything and do anything for kids,
yeah,
I can only talk about something I love, you know, which is my granddad and the guitar,
yeah,
you know. So it was, in a way, it was like taking my hats off to Gus, who was great to me.
He threw you a line. He was your lifesaver. It's a pretty, it's a cute little book, and your daughter illustrated it.
Yeah, it was a family affair.
Yeah, it was, but she did a great job. Those are really pretty.
Yeah.
It's a pretty little book. I couldn't believe I'm reading. I'm getting choked up reading a Keith Richards children's book.
Yeah. I know. I love to sort of throw you the odd. You know.
Yes, I'm listening to your record, and then I'm reading your children's book, and I'm like, what the fuck? All I wanted to do was drugs when
I'm broadening my horizons.
I'll say, man. Well, you've got some grandkids, right?
I've got five.
Five.
Yeah.
Do you love hanging out with them?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, it's worth hanging around to be a granddad, you know, yeah.
Did you ever think you would? I mean, it's
at certain times, no. No, but here I am, and there's five grandkids, and and it's another thing, you know, it takes you on another level. It's one thing being a father.
Yeah.
Which is like, fun enough.
You had a couple shots at that.
Yeah.
Yeah, two sets.
Yeah, two sets of that. And out they come, you know, but they're the great little kids.
Yeah.
And,
What, do they have a name for you? Just grandpa or granddad or what do they call you?
Grandpa.
Yeah.
Him.
Him. And you get along with all your kids?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, no, it's a very close family in that respect.
Yeah.
It's like a tribe.
How were you with your dad growing up, you know, in general? I mean, because I know you loved Gus, but your father, did you guys fight it out for a few years? Or?
I don't know. I grew up with just my mom and my dad.
Yeah.
You know, so I grew up in a very adult area. You
mm-hmm.
know? So, I mean, sometimes, you know, I was sort of, wished I had a brother or a sister so I didn't have to listen to about the arguments about the rent and the insurance and whatever,
right,
you know
right,
what I mean?
Yeah.
But there's no way out of that. So you sort of grow up in an adult household, whether you like it or not.
Yeah.
And they treat you like a kid, and at the same time, you know they have problems. And but not between themselves, but just like day-to-day living, you know what I mean? My dad worked his life for General Electric, making tubes.
Right.
So
of all things.
Of all things, yeah. And this I'll get around to in a minute. But so I leave home, 17, like the bird leaves the nest.
Yeah.
And within a year, my mum and my dad had split up. I think I was the only reason to stay around. But so I, you know, boom, suddenly I'm making some bread. I said, immediately I said, take care of mum.
Yeah.
Yeah. My dad, boom, whatever, for 20 years, no contact whatsoever.
Really?
Yeah. And in 82, I think 81, 82, I sent him, I just sent a note and said, see if you can get this through to my dad, you know. Boom,
yeah.
You know, why haven't we seen each other for so long? So my dad comes down to my house, you know, I send him, and I'd taken Ronnie Wood with me because I wanted protection. So meet my dad after 20 years, I was scared shitless.
Really?
So, yeah, in a way, you know, yeah. I mean, I needed some
kind of support.
Sure, yeah. And out comes my dad, you know, 20 years older, a little old bloke, great. And we snapped to straight away, you know. I mean, we just, like, got on. And I had more fun with him for the next 20 years. I showed him the world, you know. I said, get on this plane, come on. And he's got Brooke Shields sitting on his lap.
Yeah.
And so I gave him the whole world he hadn't seen. And for the last 20 years of his life, we were like, we played dominoes endlessly, you know, with a load of other guys, you know, and he was he liked his rum.
Uh-huh. Yeah, there you go.
But he could drink us all under the table.
Oh, know? Yeah?
It was amazing, you know.
That's beautiful, man. And your mom?
Bless her heart, yes, always saw her. And the funny thing about my mom is that she knows she's going, and I went to the hospital, you know, the clinic.
When was this?
It's 2002, uh-huh. I think.
Uh-huh.
And so I brought a guitar with me, and I was sitting on the end of the bed, and she said, Keith, this morphine's not bad, is it? You're 93 at last.
Now you get it.
Oh, that's fucking beautiful. So the new record's great, man. And
all right, like, cool, man.
Love everything you do. And now, I guess, like, to finish up, like, when you look back, not so much about regrets, but is there anything you're still pissed off about? Is anything stuck in your craw about the way things went down?
I could have lived without being busted, and without being, like, you know, cops putting things in my pocket, stuff.
Oh, right? That happened, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Got set up.
It was terrible in London.
Oh, the first big bust.
Yeah, no, it was the second one. What have we got here?
Oh, really?
But I did have the pleasure of that gentleman. His name was, at the time, was Constable.
Uh-huh.
And it was Constable, Constable.
Constable, Constable.
Yeah, he got to be sergeant or something before he was finally checked. Nothing to do with me by then, but I just read in a paper that he was sentenced to 5 years.
Oh, really? Yeah, you don't even know why. Fuck him.
Yeah, well, probably for the same thing.
Send people up.
Just corruption or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, yeah, it was a bent. Station and it's one of those things, you know. Cops ain't perfect, and nor am I.
So Ronnie's good.
Ronnie's good.
Charlie's good. You and Mick are good.
Yeah,
everything's all right.
Yeah, and looking forward to doing some more. Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks for talking to me. It was a real honor. Really fucking amazing.
Real pleasure, man. A lot of laugh.
Yeah.
And you smoked your first cigarette in 10
years. Yeah, with Keith Richards. Come on. Thanks, man.
Pleasure, man.
Keith Richards. Man. Sometimes I love my life. I really do. All right, so go to WTFpod.com/tour for all my upcoming tour dates. You can go to KeithRichards.com to get that beautiful Super Deluxe box set. And now I'll play my stinky guitar. It's not a Keith riff, but it's, you know, it's rock. It's what I do. I've probably done it before.
Boomer lives. Monkey and LaFonda. Cat angels everywhere.